Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Sankofa Radio, where we travel through the past, but we stop here in the present on our journey into the future. I'm your host, Ascari Donso, and today, man, we're going to talk about the Alabama prison riot and what exactly that means in the struggle for people trying to liberate themselves from poverty and all of the negative forces that come with living in a capitalist society. It's customary before we start the show that we give a dedication. Today I want to give a dedication to all the brothers and sisters that were trapped in a colonial prison, killed in what has been termed a prison riot, but what I like to term more so a prison rebellion or uprising. There have been countless prison rebellions and uprisings in the annals of history, and a lot of unnamed, uncelebrated people have lost their life fighting for liberation, fighting for freedom. So we're going to give our dedication to them today. Start off, man, my talk by speaking a little bit about what exactly happened on March the 12th down in Alabama. You know, apparently, from everything that I've read, the brother down there was in a little altercation between two prisoners, and the staff, correctional officer, attempted to break it up. And in the process of attempting to break it up, the officer must have in some kind of way offended a prisoner, one of the prisoners in altercation, and tried to take him out, and he got caught up, and the prisoner stabbed him with a makeshift knife. The warden came in with a goon squad, attempted to take back the pod, take back the housing unit, and the prisoners said that you're not taking over the housing unit, or you're not taking this particular person who was involved in altercation to the segregation or solitary confinement unit. The warden tried to impose his will, and apparently he got stabbed also. After which, he somehow made it out of the pod. The prisoners barricaded themselves in the pod. And while barricading themselves in the pod, they torched and lit some of the state property on fire. And so this is the basis. Essentially, this lasted for 2 or 3 days, and this essentially is what is at the core of the Alabama supposed prison riot. Now, with all of the news publications up to this point, which have been pretty much primarily the spokesman reports of what the spokesman of the Department of Corrections of the state of Alabama position has basically blamed this incident on overcrowding. It seemed to be the buzzword, overcrowding. And this is what pretty much inspired me to want to do this talk today, because anybody who's familiar at all with the history of prison riots in America in particular, one thing that's common, a common theme throughout, is that spokespersons for the state always allege that the cause of the prison rebellion is overcrowding. That if somehow there wasn't as many people in the prison, the prisoners would not rebel. It's never really attributed to the real conditions that caused the uprising. And this is for a reason. It's a way for the state to make political speak and spin of the event in a way that it doesn't seem like, you know, they're in any kind of way culpable for what exactly took place. They want to give the appearance that this is something that happened as a malfunction in the system. You know, overcrowding. This prison was designed for 500 people. We somehow, because we didn't get the funding from our Congress, end up having 800 people, and this caused tension amongst the prisoners, and the prisoners ultimately rioted. But this is not at all typically what is the root cause of prison rebellions. Okay, and that's what we're going to discuss a little bit today, because we need to know and understand what exactly is going on. So I was looking at a little definition. I want to shoot this out here about prison riots. And the definition, the bourgeois definition I read, was an act of concerted defiance or disorder by a group of prisoners against the prison administrators, prison officials, prison officers, or other groups of prisoners in attempt to force change or express a grievance. Now, the reason why that definition is important is because implicitly it denotes that the power structure has legitimate authority over the prison. So what you hear is you say is a defiance or disorder by a group of prisoners towards an administration, but it's never looked at as a position of a prisoner, an oppressed group of people attempting to liberate themselves from oppression, okay, which is something which, if we're going to look at it from that perspective, we're going to have to change the terminology from a riot to an uprising or rebellion or revolt, okay? So those are the terms that I would prefer to use when characterizing what goes on with prisoners when it is that they challenge the oppressive power structure, which is the administrations, these prison administrations, because they act on behalf of a larger oppressive group. And this is what we're going to get to today. So the first thing I want to ask the question, what does the Alabama prison riot have in common with other prison riots? Okay, so there have been numerous prison riots throughout the history of America, in the history of world history, you know, but in America in particular, there are some very notable prison riots that I think are worth mentioning here, because these prison riots are case studies of what exactly happens when poor people, oppressed people, who are locked away in these torture camps, could result to when the oppression is extremely severe, because these environments are oppressive by nature. So I don't want to give the indication that there are prisons that aren't oppressive, but there are some prisons that are so oppressive that they force an individual by their very nature to act in a way that could be considered violent by the power structure, right? So one of the first ones, I want to start from more recent times and go back a little bit. So one of the first ones I want to talk about is Natchez, Mississippi. There was a prison out there, Adams County Correctional Center, and this is a private prison. And this is the modern day issues we're dealing with today, is the private prison industry, right? They have these quotas. Private prisons come in, they do contracts with the state. They say, look, we're gonna set up a prison, we're gonna put prisoners in the prison, we're gonna pay for it, you know, we're gonna negotiate with you, you pay for it, we're gonna give it to you, we're gonna operate corrections at minimum cost. Okay. And only thing that we ask is that you keep the beds full. You know what I'm saying? We have a quota system. We want to make sure that we're operating at 90% to 95% capacity at all times. Okay, so this is how that works. And so right now, Adams County Correctional Center down in Natchez, Mississippi, it's a private prison, and it's designed specifically to house immigrants, illegal immigrants, if you want to call them that, undocumented immigrants, who have been arrested for committing crimes. And most of these guys are awaiting trial, and then if they're convicted, they're going to be deported. Some of these guys had already been deported several times. Well, there was a riot down there in 2012, and a guard was killed. And when asked, when some of the Latin brothers was asked, you know, what was going on in the prison, the conditions, they talked about poor food, they talked about, you know, pitiful medical care, they talked about disrespect from the guards, you know, just extreme oppression, you know, just racism at a rampant, at an all-time high. You had down southern white racist attitudes in the prison, you know what I'm saying, being projected on the illegals, you know what I'm saying. The whole Trumpism was going on down there, and these guys ended up rioting. And also end up getting killed, and a few prisoners end up getting killed in this riot. Another notable prison riot in the new millennium was down in Newcastle Correctional Center, Indiana, and that happened in 2007. And this again was another private prison. This particular prison, what they did was they contracted with what they call a memorandum of understanding, right? So what that is when you don't have legal authority to make a contract, you basically make a gentleman's agreement. And the way that they characterize that, sophisticatedly characterize that, is with this phrase they call a memorandum of understanding. And what the memorandum of understanding laid out was an agreement between GEO, Arizona, and Indiana, right, to bring Arizona inmates up there to Indiana, okay, and house them. So what the Arizona brothers came up there and realized is that wow, these are racist cats. We don't want to be here, three or four or five states away where we can't see our families and interact with the people we love. We want to go back. Immediately from the time that they got there, they were facing oppressive conditions because, again, private prisons operate on a minimum budget, you know, because they have to provide a service to the state at minimum cost and still make a profit. So the conditions in private prisons are some of the worst. It's reminiscent of old, you know, late 19th century penitentiary. You know, just modernized. But as far as the food is the cheapest, the clothing is the cheapest. I mean, it's horrible conditions, right? Conditions, right? So these guys end up rioting. You know, they end up beating the officer up. They could be considered more civil disobedience because they didn't really get crazy, but they, you know, they burnt up a bunch of things, set the prison on fire. And so that's another example. But they talked about the conditions of being oppressed, being forced to be removed from their home state. Another one, going back to the 90s now, you know, we talked about Southern Ohio Correctional Center, one of the more famous, notable prison riots in history. It lasted 11 days. This happened because the prison administration was just so abusive. And this is one of the most maximum security prisons in the country. You know, they used to have the death chamber there, and the prisoners didn't riot. They rioted because they didn't want to be forced to take medication that they were being forced to take based on their religious beliefs. All of the groups came together, the Gangster Disciples, which is a street organization, the Sunni Muslims, the Nation of Islam, and the Aryan Brotherhood. They all came together, you know, unlikely union right there, and said we're going to rise up against oppression. And if you have the Aryan Brotherhood, trust me, the Nation of Islam coming together, you have the conditions must have been to unite these guys. And then you have Attica. You have Attica in 1971, one of the probably the most famous prison riots in American history, where brothers rose up in response to horrible conditions in New York after politicizing themselves for several months, after George Jackson's death on August 21st, 1971. They were fed up. They were fed up, and they took over the prison. And in that riot, 53 people were killed. The state came in and slaughtered people on the yard. Now, these things are important to note because when we think about prison riots, once again, a lot of times they're characterized by the dominant culture and their bourgeois media as being just a bunch of rebel rousers, you know what I'm saying, running around, you know, doing what they do, you know what I'm saying. They commit crime on the street, they're good on the street, they're no good on the street, they're in prison, and they're just doing what they do, okay. But what's lost and what's left out a lot of times is structurally what goes into creating a criminal and what goes into creating a prisoner. And what is the purpose of the prison in society, in capitalist society in the first place? What is the role of the prison? Okay, so if you talk to an imperialistic, capitalistic, rich, wealthy individual, white, male, and female, possibly, but particularly male, they're going to tell you that the prisons are necessary for law and order. We have to protect the property interests, and we have to protect the lives of our citizens. You know, you're going to just have those people, those dregs of society who just commit crime. But I propose to you that nobody is born a criminal. The first concept I want us to come into the understanding of and the reality of, nobody is born a criminal. A criminal is made. So what constructs a criminal? What constructs the criminal mind? How does one become a criminal in his thinking? What makes a person steal? What makes a person kill? What makes a person rape? How does one get to that point? Okay, so let's deal with that. Let's deal with that just a little bit. You know what I'm saying? Let's take it back. Let's deal with the criminal and who is the criminal in American society, for the most part. So let's start with the history of America. When we think about the history of America, right? I'm here in Virginia, and Virginia could be considered the foundation of America. The James River is like the Nile River in Egypt, really. It's a historic river because really it's the river where this country began, the James River. And here, when this land was taken away from the Native Americans by the English, the original idea was to profit. right? It was actually established by the Virginia Corporation, and the Virginia Corporation sent a bunch of you know, rogue individuals over here and said, look, man, we want you to go over there. We want you to get some gold. We want you got, you know, we want you to get all the resources you can, bring them back to us. We're trying to profit. We can bring that stuff over here. We'll make money. Well, ultimately, Virginia was not a resource, gold resource rich land. So it ended up being, long story short, it ended up being a place where they had to create plantations, they had to create colonies, and they ended up having to become a more agricultural economy. And that was the way that Virginia was developed. Important to note and understanding that is that from the very beginning, there was people who were considered to be, valuable to the colony, and people who were considered to be just youth, you know, for useful labor, right? So what we see in 1619, after we see white indigenous servants being sent over here to help farm, people who are poor, people who are criminals being sent over here to help plantation owners farm and create wealth. You begin to see in 1619 that they realize we can use this free surplus labor where we don't even have to pay them. And this is when you begin to see, you know, slaves, you know, African people sent over here to do free labor, right, be caught up into free labor. And later on in the late 1600s, 1660, 1670, you begin to see the first criminalization of blackness, the first identification of whiteness. White people actually saying, I'm white, calling us black, distinguishing themselves, and using this distinguishment as a justification to be able to oppress a group of people. You know, I'm white, so I'm better than you. I'm prettier than you. I'm smarter than you. And so you're black. You're dumber than me. You're uglier than me. And so I'm justified in my enslavement of you. I'm justified in my treating you like an animal. And so they begin to write this into the law. Right, so they say, okay, if you're black and you know you're born in over here in Virginia, and your mother's a slave, then you're a slave. You're a slave forever. You know what I'm saying? And they say, if you're black, you can't own guns, and if you're black, you can't own property. And so now we begin to see the first criminalization of blackness. So first criminal, some of the first crimes were criminalizing black skin. And then on top of that, you've seen whites who didn't have money, who may have been illiterate, also being criminalized in a particular way, because as indentured servants, they had to spend 6, 7 years in servitude. But if they ran or escaped, they could be sent into servitude for an additional 10, 15, 20 years. And in some cases, they wasn't even let out their indenture. They was forced to have to stay into their indenture contract for even longer. So what we see is the criminalization of people being, the goal of criminalizing people being to keep them in a position where they had to serve the people who were making the laws in the first place. So the people who are making the laws are criminalizing these people to keep them in an oppressed state is what we're seeing. So the law from the very beginning is designed, right, to keep a group of people in an oppressed state so that the power structure can benefit and capitalize off their labor. Okay, so we have an official slave code being established here in Virginia in 1705, right? The official slave code is just, I mean, it's laid out. It's, you know, if you're black, you're in Virginia, you're a slave. You know, if you're free, you know, we don't want you over here. I mean, it's just all types of, they got nice. You know what I'm saying? They got nice. So now we see, from the punishment standpoint, we see that on the plantation, when it comes to people who violate the law, whether it be you run, whether it be you rebel, there was all types of plantation rules on top of the state law, because the plantation rules, really, plantation justice is really how slaves were regulated. You see whippings, you see branding, you see all types of things going on as a result of people not following rules. And so the law and the order was designed to keep people in a certain oppressed condition and to maintain the order of oppression. Okay, this is what we see when we see what was the role of punishment early. As you get a development, as you develop your society, and you free these people after there's a civil war to determine what's going to be the economic model for the country, whether it's going to be a slave capitalistic society or whether it's going to be an industrial capitalistic society. And the Northerners obviously wanted industry, and that's what they fought for under the guise of freeing black people and some moral cause. That might have been in there somewhere down the line, but the chief objective was industrializing the nation. Well, once they get to that point where they allow African people now, American African people now, to be free, you know, what happens is you need you know, institutions now to be able to punish these people. Where in the South, though, it wasn't an easy transition, right? So in the South, what you see is the black codes, which are designed specifically, again, to maintain a social order, to maintain white supremacy. Okay, so now you have vagrancy, one of the most ridiculous and absurd laws in not only American history, but human history. Vagrancy is just this wide-ranging, sweeping, unidentifiable, you know what I'm saying, laws that basically can criminalize anything. If you don't have a job and you're out in the middle of the day and the police also walks up to you and you don't have a place to go, we can lock you up. If you owe money to your plantation, I mean to your supervisor on the plantation that you make sharecrop for, we can lock you up if you're out past a certain time without a pass. And these are free people who still need passes to be out at a certain time of night. We can lock you up. Vagrancy was just wide range, and a lot of people got swept up in vagrancy laws. And what happened is there was this re-enslavement of people under the guise of incarcerating them. In the South, that put people on prison camps where, you know, they went to these prison camps and they worked and their labor was utilized to build a nation. So here in Virginia, you had a whole bunch of prison camps, a whole bunch of ball and chain prison camps where prisoners were sent out to work and build the railroads, build the power grids, build the dams of this country. And a lot of this was built on prison labor, but it was prison labor for people who really hadn't really done any crime outside of just being black and being in the wrong place at the wrong time. So now moving forward, going into segregation or Jim Crow South, we know and understand that all types of African people, just purely off being black alone, were being given an arbitrary standard of justice, right? So many times black people were blamed for crimes whites committed, white juries in the South. Just and in the North, let's don't play this game like the North wasn't as racist. They set the standard for Jim Crow. So you would see these white juries in the North and the South and in the West criminalizing blacks in most cases either more harsh than they deserved or in most cases where they were even innocent for crimes that maybe other whites might have committed or that they didn't commit at all in a way that put them in the prison. And it was used as a way to control the population of blacks in there and send messages to blacks that, look, you're nothing. You know, you're in a white supremacy state, you're nothing. So this is important for us to understand who is the criminal, what has been the criminal, you know what I'm saying? And moving into the 60s, in the 70s, what we begin to see is that there's a movement, yeah, right, a social movement sweeping the nation. People are beginning to challenge the power structure, environmentalists, racist, feminist movements. All these are taking place, and there's this movement towards reforming the prison. And you're seeing it in the courts. Right, you're seeing it in the court. So the prison system is beginning to change, but it's beginning to change because of what's going on in society. And in the 60s, you begin to see a lot more activism in the prisons, quiet little rebellions in the prisons. This is when you begin to see a lot more rebellions in the prisons. And then your Attica happens in the 1970s. You have what's going on in the California prison system with George Jackson in the late 60s, early 70s. You got Attica. Early 70s, you also got Oklahoma, cows to Oklahoma, and so you know you got what happened in West Virginia in the 80s, and so you're starting to see these prison riots where brothers are starting to say, yo, you know, we tired, and this is the result of the 60s, it's the legacy of the 60s, but the prison riots again are the result of oppressed people wanting and demanding a better quality of treatment. And we got to make this connection because at the end of the day, what we're talking about is oppressed people just really wanting to be free. Now, I'm going to talk about a concept called entrapment. I'm going to leave that criminal, the idea of criminal, because I think you get where I'm going with the criminalization. Who's the criminal in America? Who has been the criminal in America? Now, I want to talk about entrapment, because some people say, well, look, I hear what you're saying, man, but nowadays, you know, dudes just got to take responsibility. You know what I'm saying? It ain't the people out there making them kill each other. It ain't the people out there making them terrorize the neighborhood. And granted, I agree with that. Black-on-black crime and black-on-black violence is a problem that needs to be corrected. But black-on-black crime, black-on-black violence is a symptom of a larger. It's not the actual ailment itself. White supremacy is the ailment. And let me show you how this works. So black people traditionally in this country have been the poorest group. We've always been the most poor people in the society. You can check the data. There's never been a poor group of people in America than American African people. That is our legacy in America. Poor, exploited group. That's who we are to America. That's our relationship to the country. Okay? Now, if I was to take homeless man and I was to take $100, okay, and on a wall across the street from where he was laying and sleeping every night. And he woke up, and I left, and nobody was around, and he took the $100. Although I had a wallet right there, and he took that, and he went and bought some food. If I went and told the police and they charged him with a crime, would that be considered to be entrapment? Would that be considered to be wrong? My question is, if you take an oppressed group of people, poor, you put them in a concentrated area where they don't have a lot of access to education, they don't have a lot of access to resources. So people do the best they can to survive. The number one instinct for every fucking species in the world is survival, right? If I take and I see a bug running across the floor and I stump my foot at him, he's going to run in the opposite direction because the bug is trying to survive, right? So any living species, number one instinct is to survive. So you put a bunch of poor people in a concentrated area who only want to survive, man. But they don't really know how to survive outside of, you know, doing what they see being done in America every day, which is committing crimes, doing what you got to do. So they rob. You know, guns are in the neighborhood. I don't know how the guns got there, so they use the guns to rob. They sell drugs. The drugs are in the neighborhood. How did they get in? You know, we don't know boats. We don't know planes. But the drugs is there. You know what I'm saying? There's an opportunity for us to make money to create another economy with the drugs and the guns. So how else would you think somebody who doesn't have education, doesn't have a lot of opportunities, how else would you think they would involve themselves in the American economy and be able to produce? Because we're all in debt in America, right? We're born in debt, right? From the very time that you're born, you owe bills for your birth, right? So how it is, you know, and then you have to pay rent and then for food, and, you know, they even charge brothers to live in the prisons now, you know what I'm saying? So how is it that a person who was born in debt is supposed to survive this society, this capitalist society, if I don't have any skill set, but the crime is around me? Is how we have to begin to understand black-on-black violence and black crime. You know, this is how we have to begin to understand exactly what's going on in the prisons and what's going on in the black community, why it is that blacks are committing the crime they're committing. It's because of poverty. It's because of lack of education. It's because of a pestilent culture that has developed in these conditions over centuries now. This is not something that happens in a vacuum, and this is not something that is unique or foreign to oppressed people. You know, look at what's going on in the Middle East. You see poor people who don't have a lot of education. They're cutting each other heads off in the name of a God, you know, that nobody really knows exists. And so this is the example of what happens when you have these material conditions. This is what it produces, okay? So now, bringing it back to Alabama. The brothers in Alabama were said that they were rioting because of overcrowding. And the first thing that the state correctional agency. All right, good luck, dog. Excuse me. We're going to come back on the other end of the break. Excuse me, he's having some technical difficulties. So getting back to what I was saying, so in Alabama, what they were trying to say is that essentially the issue was overcrowding. And because they said the issue was overcrowding, the reason why they were saying the issue was overcrowding is because they want to get money. First of all, they want to get the support of the people. But then they want to get money to be able to build new prisons, new larger prisons, to be able to contain and concentrate more criminals. And who are the criminals? The criminals are poor people. And who are the poor people? The poor people in this country are black people. That is our relationship to the state. You see, so we have to understand that once they get into these prisons, as you've seen in Natchez, Mississippi, where the Latin brothers we're going to have to continue this. I'm sorry for the delay. We're going to have to continue this. We have 10 seconds. Free all political prisoners, man, and don't believe the hype. Yehovah.